Studio 360.
As a New Yorker with all the artists and all the hundreds of galleries and museums, I tend to take visual art somewhat for granted. But the obvious cosmopolitan coastal hub cities aren't the only American places where art lives and matters. Good and occasionally great art gets made and adored everywhere. In places, for instance, like Northeast Ohio. Starting this month in and around Cleveland, the Front International Triennial for Contemporary Art is happening. It's a vast show in 28 venues featuring new work by more than 100 artists invited from all over America and the world. It runs until the end of September. As a fan of new art and living artists, as well as a transplanted Midwesterner, I took a rooting interest in Front the moment I heard about it, and went to Cleveland to check it out as the organizers and artists were rushing toward the opening. I start downtown with the guy who dreamed it all up. He's a retired advertising executive and art collector named Fred Bidwell.
Welcome to Cleveland.
Thank you. Now, here we are. We're not just by chance here in the middle of downtown near Playhouse Square. We're next to this 12-story wall of this building that's been painted white. That is one of your venues. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, in front of this wall is an enormous bucket truck that can extend all the way up to the top, and that's going to contain a painter starting next week who's going to recreate a lost masterpiece by the Op Art founder, Julian Stanzak.
Now, Op Art, short for optical art, was a movement that had its big moment starting in the 1960s. The paintings are abstract, graphic, geometric, often with super bright, day-glowish colors, trippy but rigorous, and the canvases seem electric, like they throb. And in the early 1970s, an internationally acclaimed op artist named Julian Stanzak happened to live in Cleveland, and he was commissioned by the city to paint a gigantic mural downtown, which, like a lot of American downtowns at the time, was emptying out. Julian's painting covered the side of a building, this dense 12-story grid of blue and green rectangles and red lines that looked, op art, like a field of vibrating pinks and purples. The mural was worn away by weather after just a few years. For this fresh replica of the mural that's going up in the exact same place in Playhouse Square, the Front organizers specified new, improved 21st century paint that should last longer.
It's an incredible wall. Huge. And of course, the painting is this stunning, vibrating op art, a riot of color that's just going to sort of be a bit mind blowing at this scale.
Yeah. Julian, alas, died not long ago, but oversaw the beginnings of this project, and his widow, Barbara Stanzak, is here up the hill. Let's go find her and talk to her.
All right, great.
It's coming together.
Hi, I'm
Hello.
Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
Good to meet you.
My name.
Barbara Stanzak is an artist as well, a sculptor, and she's been overseeing the project the last year in her late husband's absence. So this was done almost 50 years ago. Do you remember when it was
1973, 72, 73,
right.
That fall.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he really became very prominent in the kind of work he did in the 1960s mm-hmm. and early 70s, which was called op art, short for mm-hmm. optical art. Your late husband had such an extraordinary life, like a work of fiction, mm-hmm. of growing up in Poland during World War II and escaping to Tehran and going to Uganda and being in a camp and making his way here and becoming an artist eventually. It's interesting, given the narrative color of his life, it mm-hmm. never made its way into his work, right?
Not the narrative. He ran away from remembering the atrocities that he had gone through. So abstraction can open up a different passageway, a different viewpoint on the world. He did want to share color, probably his Africa experience, being 7 years in a camp in Africa, and the lusciousness of nature around were the greatest intuition all his life. He did love nature, but he wanted not to copy it, but to transform it and to parallel the potency of color for others in order to be able to share it.
Julian emigrated to America in the 1950s to Ohio, where he got a job teaching art and met Barbara. A decade later, he was successful, showing in New York City and all over the world. But he stayed in Cleveland, Barbara says, as a very conscious choice.
We needed peace. Julian needed respite. He needed to withdraw from action. We live in a community where nobody knows who we are or what we do. They might think painter, okay, it's a
sign painter.
It's a sign painter or wall painter in houses. We like to be inconspicuous so we can focus on the work. The work is the importance, and also the human relations, to have a good family, to take care of the parents, etc., etc.
By the way, for listeners who don't know where we are in Cleveland and don't know downtown Cleveland, this is about as prominent a place as you can get here on Playhouse Square and everything else. I mean, lots and lots and lots of people are going to see this for the next at least 5 years.
Hopefully more. Julian's gift to the city. Well, the first one was the city's gift to Julian. So now Julian is giving back.
From the downtown district, I head west to a little neighborhood called Hingetown. It is freshly gentrified, and so new, I discovered, that lots of lifelong Clevelanders haven't even heard of it yet. A few blocks of old industrial spaces repurposed as pour-over coffee shops, a vegan sandwich spot, a boxing gym. And at Hingetown Center is another beautiful remnant of old Cleveland, a brick electrical power substation built in the 1920s. Fred Bidwell and his wife Laura bought and expanded it and turned it into a public art space. They call it Transformer Station, and I head up to the library area on the mezzanine, which is this cool concrete and brick spot that looks out over the rest of the gallery, to talk again with Fred, as well as his curator for the front triennial, Michelle Grabner.
Front and American City. Explain both of those things.
An American City is the title of this inaugural edition. So Front International Cleveland Triennial for Contemporary Arts, our full, lengthy full name. Kept on thinking of these words like frontier, upfront, you know, forefront, confront. And I thought, wow, you know, front does it. Front really expresses the idea that, you know, we're always on the leading edge.
Yeah. And in American City, there's something kind of generic about that. Is that deliberate?
Often when we think about cities, we think about those big coastal influencers, whether it's New York or Los Angeles. And the idea of saying an American city with its maybe slight modesty, really thinking about those cities in the American interior and how they offer and support culture.
Right. Cleveland doesn't have an especially strong artistic cosmopolitan reputation. I mean, is that part of the attraction for you guys of doing this here? Like, it's virgin territory in a kind of international artistic sense?
People don't think of Cleveland as sort of a big artistic hub, but ironically, actually it has extraordinary resources. Because it was one of the richest cities in the country in the teens and 20s,
In the early 1800s.
Yeah. As all of these institutions were created and endowed by these industrial giants. So Cleveland Museum of Art, the Akron Art Museum, the Allen Memorial Art Museum. You know, these are extraordinary institutions with incredible collections, amazing facilities. So one of the ideas behind Front is let's pull all of these incredible resources together. Seven institutions as full collaborators in Northeast Ohio and create so much critical mass that people can't fly over.
Yeah.
They've got to land and see it.
Yeah.
You know, road trips are really important, and not a lot of people take road trips anymore. My students in Chicago, they fly to New York. They don't take a road trip to New York. And, you know, if they would have, they would have stopped in Cleveland and understand, again, the richness of the institutions here. As I did back in the 80s as a student, we would stop at, in front of the Cleveland Museum of Art, and we would look at the collection.
Right.
Yeah, we hope to trick a lot of people into seeing contemporary art this summer because people are just going to bump into it. And hopefully it'll raise a few questions and generate curiosity for more.
One of the art pieces you could just bump into is a sculpture by A.K. Burns, who lives in New York City and created this work just for front. Her medium is chain-link fencing. But instead of standing up straight, like fences, these 8-foot pieces are aggressively warped and twisted into hunched and leaning forms.
And then this is going to be the bottom. Gets tipped up.
I find AK just as the sculptures are being installed, and in the shade of a big tree, they appear to be painted glossy black.
Well, so it's not exactly painted black. It's actually painted with a chameleon car finish. So when the light hits it, we're not seeing it very active.
I get what you're saying. No, it's beautifully, gorgeously shiny.
Yeah, so it's going to oscillate between a deep purple and a green when the light hits it. And part of that is just sort of the optical effect that I wanted as you maneuver or circulate the object.
AK tells me that the idea for the fencing started out as a response to the gentrification of this formerly gritty neighborhood, Hingetown, where construction fencing is ubiquitous. But for her, the meaning goes way beyond that literal allusion.
Working with the fencing, for me, has to do with, borders, divisions. It stems just even personally from my own body and the ways that I think about gender. For example, I'm masculine performing, but female identified.
Uh-huh.
and that's very intentional because I'm not interested in actually aligning with a gender that makes me comfortable, because I'm interested in complicating how the borders of how the body is policed in different ways.
I get that.
Policed all the way out to sort of larger political ramifications.
Uh-huh, right.
So while this did stem from kind of thinking about the gentrification in this neighborhood, for me it should hold the symbolic weight of, I think, that extends beyond that,
uh-huh.
Right? I actually wanted these to be kind of beautiful in the end, to kind of make it dysfunctional and then thereby make it beautiful is actually kind of an act in undoing its
right.
its original agenda. And they're called the dispossessed. I just like that word, like the not possessed, to not possess.
Uh-huh.
What was your sense of and feeling about this idea of Cleveland creating this triennial and becoming this center of contemporary art?
I am a city dweller because that's where I've chosen to make my career. But I have spent a considerable amount of my life not being a city person. Actually, in the midst of moving upstate.
So you're telling me you're not a fancy urban snob. And so Cleveland's just fine with you.
I don't want to understate that, but
yeah,
I'm a big fan of the road trip.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, I think the quote-unquote second city, it's this idea that art doesn't exist in other places, or you can only be in New York to make art. I don't know. It's not something I buy into. I mean, I bought into it enough to go there and realize that I needed to get my footing
right.
in New York, but I don't see it as
right.
the primary source of creativity. And certainly not now. I mean, part of why I'm moving upstate is I can't afford to stay in New York
right.
City. And I think most artists are feeling that way. So I think we're only going to see more second city, quote
right.
unquote, emergence of really productive
right.
creativity happening in other places.
I'm with you. Light out for the territories.
Yeah.
Next, I head down the street to a gallery and art incubator called Spaces, where I meet up with two artists behind a citywide participatory art project called A Color Removed. Their idea is to cull orange items, clothing, toys, furniture, appliances, garbage, really orange anything and everything from all over Cleveland. Because Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old Cleveland boy killed by police in 2015, he had been holding a toy gun that lacked the requisite orange plug in its barrel.
A witness who called the police said that the boy was pointing a pistol that was, quote, probably fake and scaring people. Police say the officer fired two shots after the boy pulled the fake weapon from his waistband.
R.A. Washington is a local writer, publisher, bookstore owner who is collaborating on this project with an artist from Chicago named Michael Rakowitz.
For me, like, getting involved with Michael wasn't necessarily because I felt like Tamir's story was an African-American one. I think Tamir's story is an American story, and it's America's responsibility to make sure that black children don't get murdered by the police. And that is what the project will ultimately do. Will give a place for people to talk about an uncomfortable thing. And also to really just highlight Miss Rice and in the work that she's continuing to do.
Tamir's mother.
Yeah, Tamir's mother for children in Cleveland. Like, she's taking a tragedy, something that no one could ever imagine happened to them, and she's empowering herself and empowering others to protect kids. So to me, it's not necessarily preaching to the choir. It's about hope.
I was watching along with many other people around the country as Tamir Rice was murdered.
This is Michael Rakowitz.
And in the police debrief afterwards, I found it interesting and also infuriating the kind of victim blaming that went on when they said that they could not tell that it was a toy gun because its orange tip had been removed.
Tamir had gotten the gun from a friend who told investigators that he had removed the orange tip, the safety tip, that the gun had come with. And we have the model that had been purchased at a local Walmart. And you'll see that as purchased, this airsoft pistol should have had that orange safety tip to hopefully alert officers that this, in fact, was a toy. But the pistol that Tamir had that day had no such tip.
And so I started to think, what would it mean then if this boy could not live with safety because of the lack of orange on his toy gun? What would it mean to redact orange throughout a city like Cleveland?
So it's a normal gallery space, painted white. What will happen in there to invite people to place orange things?
Well, it'll happen inside and also outside the gallery. I mean, throughout the city, I think we're locating between a dozen and 15 spaces, public and also within businesses, where drop boxes will be placed. And the drop boxes will have text on them describing exactly what they are and why they're there, and serve as a place where people can bring their objects, and then we'll collect from there frequently, and then, you know, collect them, I mean, put them on the wall and on shelves that will be between the columns that are in the back room of spaces.
So part of your work will be to figure out where and how to place things.
Exactly. But it'll, like I said, it'll be a very live thing where throughout the duration of the project's run during Front, from July 15th until September 30th, somebody could just arrive, you know, from Frankfurt, you know, and bring an orange object or from wherever. Yeah.
Orange puma. Orange soccer puma.
Yeah.
Well, I thought you meant a living animal. That would be interesting, too.
And I appreciate and applaud Michael for being able to stick in there with a community that was in grief, that doesn't get hurt often, that was taking it personal, and they should have. And having really difficult conversations with him about, well, why do you want to do this? And he stuck in there and had the conversations. And this wonderful piece with a lot of great collaborators is going to take place now, where, you know, maybe it would have just been him doing some work. You know, now it's like six of us. And that's pretty awesome.
I head 5 minutes down the road to the West Side Market. It opened in 1912 for sellers of all kinds of produce and meats, which it still does a century later. It's lunchtime and busy when I meet up with my next guide, Laura DeMarco, who is a lifelong Clevelander and an arts reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
Whenever I have visitors from out of town, this is always on the first stop. I recently brought someone from Berlin here, actually, and she was amazed by it. She said, this is better than anything we have in Berlin. This is real.
No, this is beautiful. It's like Grand Central Station,
yeah,
practically.
It does look like a train station.
And with that shiny subway tile of a kind that now every fancy interior decorator in America specifies.
You know, it's a gorgeous
it's
market.
Gorgeous. With a beautiful terracotta tile arched roof as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
As you can see, there's meat. You're going to see a lot of carcasses as you walk around. Very authentic.
Wow.
Any kind of sausage, you know, as you could.
I would buy. I would live in an apartment near here just to be near here. You know. But bakers, meat.
Oh, this is so much great baked goods. Yeah.
And clearly, like a thriving set of businesses.
Yeah, as you saw the parking lot, you can hardly get in here on a Friday.
Yeah, it's great. I'm astounded it didn't get torn down sometime.
Yes.
I'm astounded it has been in continuous use as this all this time.
It's remarkable. I mean, I actually wrote a book that came out last year called Lost Cleveland. It's about 65, sadly, lost landmarks for Cleveland. And we lost so much because we did have a great rise and fall. We were a big city. We were the fifth largest city at one point, a very wealthy city because of John D. Rockefeller and industry and so on. So we had all this huge infrastructure. And then in the 60s, Cleveland's population plummeted. There was such a loss of jobs. And so many things were torn down. The West Side Market, I mean, fortunately, people had to keep eating. Maybe that was the reason why. It preserved.
How are you doing today?
Thank you.
How are you?
Pick any one you like. Which one you like, pick it out.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Of course, I'm not at the West Side Market just for the history and the hurly-burly. The market's also acting as a kind of gallery space for another front artist whom I meet outside.
I'm John Ripanoff. I'm an artist from Milwaukee, and I'm participating in front as a resident artist. So for the last year or so, I've been making sort of frequent visits to Cleveland from Milwaukee and other places that I've been traveling. And for the triennial, I designed a new sausage, kind of based on some of the research I've been doing here in Cleveland. And I'm building tandoor ovens in a few public spaces to kind of engage different communities and also to create hearths for people to kind of come together and connect over food.
The research John did was at community meetings and in galleries and studios and local urban farms around Cleveland. And the art that he's created is a sausage that he calls the Cleveland Curry Koji Wurst. It mixes flavors of old immigrant Cleveland, paprika and coriander, with some from new immigrant Cleveland, cumin and ginger and saffron. John trained as an artist in conventional media, pencil, paint, clay, but living in Milwaukee, he says, led him to redefine what an art practice could be.
It's a small city. It's similar scale as Cleveland, similar history with the rise and fall of industry. But through that, I was kind of forced to collaborate with non-artist identified ideators and business people in Milwaukee. And through that, it was a natural trajectory for me. I still work in sculpture and painting and other art forms, but to start working with food as a medium.
And so this special front triennial sausage you've made and are making will be that this is where you'll be
this
presenting
is where,
that?
Yep, it'll be like
this is your gallery?
Yeah, this is my host venue and visitors will be invited to either, you know, you can buy a cooked sausage off the menu and I'll invite you guys to come taste a little bit of one of our prototypes. Uh-huh. But you can also buy packages of it to take home and barbecue. Maybe grill on one of the tandoor ovens in the community, or maybe just grill on your backyard grill.
What about when just somebody shows up and says, yeah, I'll take one of those, and he goes or she goes, well, it's art? What?
To me, that's the biggest gift I can give to civilization is to change the way that people think about.
So it's not this thing that puts you off and you have to have an MFA and be an elitist to get.
Exactly. And if you are an MFA or an art historian, I think you're going to love the sausage too.
Good.
John invites Laura DeMarco and me into the West Side Market Cafe, which is this great little old-fashioned restaurant that's been there, I guess, forever, tucked into a corner of the market building. He wants us to try his Cleveland curry koji wurst.
Okay, let me set you up.
But before we chow down, I ask Laura what she thought of Front and its dream of nudging Cleveland toward becoming a contemporary art hub.
I thought it was great. I thought it was very audacious and ambitious, but I thought that it was something that Cleveland could use, would be do well here, and that it fits the city. I mean, we are, you know, a mid-sized city at this point. We are a city with a rich arts culture and history, and we're a city where, as we mentioned earlier, more younger people are moving back, and it just seems like the time is right for something like this.
I'm excited for you.
Oh, thanks. Cleveland. Well, yeah, we are Cleveland. We are excited in Cleveland, yes.
And should we eat some of John's art? May we eat some of John's art?
Yes, we're ready. Yep, the sausage is hot and ready.
The Front International Cleveland Triennial for Contemporary Art is happening until September 30th. Big thanks to Studio 360's Lauren Hansen, who came with me to Cleveland, and to Justin Glansville for his production help there. To find out more and to see some photos of my visit and some of the works I saw, go to studio360.org.